The opinions expressed in the following podcast are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide education and entertainment about the financial industry and the stock market. Enjoy.
On this episode of Pennies Going In Raw, we welcome back the king of dad memes, Doug Bonaparte.
You find out life's this game of pennies.
Oh, you guys know we only have a 40% runner. Hello, 40% right is a f***ing killing.
We've been compliant for too long. It's time we go to war.
I don't have a Roth.
Q knows so much about the market that his brain doesn't have enough room for grammar.
Hey, who told me about IDEX? It's going up a shit ton now.
Rob, 4%, baby.
No way.
4%.
You asked the exact same question with two words different.
It's like, f***, man, I just got dick whipped for like 20%, and now that f***er's up like 50.
I bet Warren Buffett never did that.
I'm just making this voice memo to call out unusual whales to a fight.
The pennies we need are everywhere around us.
Pennies.
Going in raw.
Featuring Dan, Deity of Dips,
and Hugh Honey.
Produced by Vinny
and Christian.
Let's go, baby.
Hey guys, we are on a break right now. We are, you know, traveling or in Reno. We will be back around the 9th of September. However, we still recorded a podcast for you. Make sure to like us and give us a 5-star rating on Apple. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Pennies Going In Raw. Today is whatever day we drop it, and we have on Doug Bonaparte. How are you?
Hey guys, great to be back.
Dude, it's been a while, I feel like.
It's been a little while. There's now double the amount of episodes of PGIR, I think.
Wow, has it been that long?
I think so. I was in the
Yeah, you were on episode 26.5, the king of 0.5s. And well, this is going to be in the 50s, so.
That's insane.
First off, congrats to you guys on the iHeartRadio deal. Massive. Can you believe it?
It's awesome, and I wanted to congratulate you on being on Pennies Going In Raw. I mean, that's huge. that's huge for you, Doug.
Massive. People won't stop talking about it.
You know, it's funny because I think we've hinted at the iHeart deal. Well, actually, we're not shocked at the iHeart deal. We're shocked that we kept it a secret. I mean, we probably posted it 4 different times. Like someone commented, like, didn't I see this in February? I was like, yeah. Like, you saw it in February. You're just re-seeing it.
Yeah.
It took forever, but you know.
Yeah, and I'm not a good secret keeper, man. I'm really bad.
Yeah, I know. When I went we, I meant you.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I always say my mom always knows her Mother's Day gift within like a week and a half of Mother's Day being around. So.
You know, I'll tell you this. If there's anything I've learned about being in wealth management for like 17, 18 years, all the biggest deals, all the really important ones that moved the meter or were changing, you know, my life or anything like that, those big ones always took time. They always went 10 times slower than I would want them to be. And because they're big deals, you want them to move fast, but they never do. They never do. And you guys will just have more and more of this. So, you know, you got to be patient on that. And I'm glad Dan didn't ruin it for everyone.
Okay. Well, I mean, we'll just hop right in, Doug. We'll hop right in where you left off. Bitcoin, you know, you have your story of you mined all this Bitcoin. Are you like a billionaire now? How is that? Like what's being a crypto billionaire like?
It's not as glamorous as you think. People are asking you for your Satoshis all the time. No, it's what a ride, guys. I mean, when we were talking, we must have hit up the 65,000. I'm trying to get the timeline.
Yeah, we were quickly climbing. I mean, we had even talked that that there's a potential for 100. Like that's how strong Bitcoin was.
Right. It was running. Yeah. And now here we are in crypto winter, you know. But is it really? I mean, it's kind of kind of insane to go from the 20,000 peak back in 2017 of, you know, now we're resting around 40,000. It's really struggling to break through that 40K resistance. Tried to do it a couple times. Again, I haven't touched it. I've made little additions along the way, some little nibbling here and there, but it's hard to really add to the position, that original position. Yeah, because it's so big. You can, you know, there's just not enough free cash. No, I mean, look, it's really goal oriented, trying to, I don't know if this is our forever home. We got goals along those lines, just saving up for that and putting the kids through college. And
just waiting for a realtor to accept Bitcoin, right?
That's right. No, I'm not giving it away ever. It's just going to stay right where it is. It's a crazy ride. I mean, and if you've been holding on since 2014, I don't really think any price action at this point is going to make me, you know, I think any price action down is not going to make me move. Only up. It'd get to a point where I'd probably relinquish something.
Yeah. Do you have a strategy, like an exit plan, or is it just kind of like, meh, like if it hits like the 100K mark, you know, I'll take half off. Is that kind of like the plan, or is it just kind of we'll save?
Close. We, you know, my wife and I had to think about, you know, at what price point would we, you know, want to sell maybe one or two Bitcoins, and what we would put that for. So we have a number in mind. If it hits, it's just an automatic sell. It's not everything. And that would really kind of put us in a nice position for some of the things that we want to do. So there is a plan in place. We're not there. And we'll see. I'm still kind of waiting for, you know, the Bitcoin ETF to show up. I think I'm more focused on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in the context of my practice and how we're going to be able, as a smaller RIA, you know, I mean, who would have thought $100 million in assets is small? But it's, dude, that's microscopic compared to, you know, wealth managers out there with multiple billions of dollars. So it's been a challenge. We're still looking for that way to practically integrate, you know, doing this for our clients. Right now, it's just let's educate them and show them, you know, how they can do this on their own and get their knowledge up. It's frustrating not to be able to be like, great, you know, let's put this in the portfolio.
Well, I do. It's funny that you mentioned that, because it was something that we did want to touch on. But our friends, Breathe Carolina, we love them. And we had a conversation about their business. And I always think it's funny. So you touched on it. You know, I mean, $100 million is a lot. But as you said, I mean, yeah, there's people that, like, I mean, you take Soros, Simon, I mean, they closed down their doors in the 90s. And, I mean, imagine they would be like at the trillions AUM. So if you could, would you want to be bigger? Like, would you want to get into the bees? Or is it one of those things where, like, you, or tell me.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. One Heather asks me all the time, like, where does the ambition lie? Where does it stop? I right now don't think it scales itself up to $1 billion. I think I could go double, triple, maybe quadruple, like $500 million. Because what I then start to do is think about how many people it takes to get there, what kind of footprint I need, the resources, and most importantly, how much of my time is going to go into this. I got two daughters. I love going to all of their stuff. You know, any major CEO or anyone, you know, being the real deal boss here is making some big sacrifice to the time and things that they get to do in their life. And I don't know. There's something about the lifestyle practice. And to be fully honest, it's an internal conflict with me. You know, I've yet to hit the switch that says, you know what, we'll get as much daycare as possible. We'll fill in, you know, Dad Doug here so he can go grow this business all the way. I'm not willing to do that at the moment. And it's, you know, at the same time, as comfortable as this spot is, I also don't want to rest on my laurels, right? Like, you don't want to get caught up in that, not at 36. So I could see a couple advisors, like, in the grand scheme of things, I could see a couple advisors, two staff per advisor, and maybe some other things here. I mean, that's big. You know, right now it's a firm of three. What if it was 12? Like, gives me goosebumps to think about I'm going to be somewhat responsible for the lives of the professional lives of 11 people.
Yeah. Well, you did just hire someone, right? And it wasn't us. You know, I don't know where our resumes went, Dan.
Oh, I shredded them immediately.
I mean, I don't know if, I mean, you did just say something, and I don't want to, you know, work for a boss I can't trust. You said you, you love going to all your daughter's events, so like under 8 soccer games, you find joy in this.
I find joy. So I'll tell you the story. You know, my older one a couple of years ago had her like first dance recital. We're talking a 4-year-old's dance recital. So, you know, it's going to be real talent up on the stage. And I'm there, you know, being calm and cool. And sure enough, like I vowed never to be that guy that's going to jump up on his seat and be like, that's my daughter. And that's exactly what I did.
you see the one on the far left. That's mine. That's my girl.
that is 100% my daughter, and I just went nuts, and I'm like, okay, this is unavoidable. But yeah, I mean, there's two sides to it, you know. The soccer game, sure, you're watching the kids run around and all, but I'm a full contact dad, you know. There's no avoiding this.
I was just gonna ask, are you still like being a predator to millennials in your business strategy, or have you moved on to like the Gen Zers?
That's a great question. I think the new hire will you know be able to go down to Gen Z and replicate a lot of the stuff that I've done and capture that market.
Start a TikTok or something.
Yeah, I don't even know if the TikTok's going to be the thing that does it. But you know, for me, getting into you know more geriatric millennials, like I don't push the advisor for millennial thing as hard as I did in the beginning because you know that was new.
They're getting old. They're phasing
out.
Yeah,
we're on geriatric millennials. You know, are tired and chasing kids around and stuff like that. The national kind of attention to the brand and what we were able to do with SEO and all of that good stuff is now paying off with like the pipeline opening up and. Don't have to kind of hit that millennial thing. The media will certainly come to me and say, hey, what's going on with your generation? But I feel like we're kind of done here. Like millennials, you know, on their way out, you know, Gen Z on their way in. And that's okay because we kind of took our stab at, you know, this generation and it's been good. So, yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting to see that baton change hands here. I hope the new guy's name's Cliff. Cliff has a great opportunity to really make that his thing.
Is he studying for his licenses right now, or is he?
Yeah, that intro exam, I believe he's taking it on Monday, right? The SEI.
Yeah, the SIE. Yeah.
We didn't have that when I was getting licensed.
That was brand new, like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I went right into my 7 and then a 66, which was okay. Which was the combination of a 65 and a 63. And we're an RIA, so all you need is your 65 here. So he's got to do that intro exam, then 65, and then his CFP. So he's got a few years of edumacation to go.
Yeah, and that's not easy edumacation. That is, I saw those textbooks. I don't even think I've read that many pages inside my education career for as long as that CFP textbook is.
Yeah, you got 6 modules to get through in a comprehensive test. Even that's changed since, you know, I did it. You get to take that comprehensive in one day on a computer. I went down to Pace University 2 days in a row to take a written exam. But I'm excited for them. There's definitely a lot to learn in there.
Yeah. So, I mean, touching on your going back to your business. So for anyone that doesn't know, Dougie over here started as a little Dougie inside the business, right? Can you tell that story about how you started?
Yeah. You know, I had a real nice inside track. I was having way too much fun in college. And I think my dad was like, oh my God, what's going to happen to this kid? We got to get him some practical skills. And I came home the summer after my freshman year and there was a Series 7 manual on my bed. He said, see if you can knock this out. You know, I hate to say like the rest is history. No, it's like 17 years between then and now. But one of the advantages that I had was getting to touch and do a lot of things in wealth management, being a financial advisor. I don't think anyone would really do. So I really leveraged that experience and early start to my advantage to get where I am today. It's, you know, it's crazy. 36 and 18 years. That's like almost half my life.
Yeah. I mean, so the biggest thing is that when my friends send me your tweets, they're like, is he serious when he's like tweeting? Like, it's like, but the thing is that if you read your tweets, I mean, you know, you have your jokes, but then you also have your nuggets in there that you know, you're coming off, you know, in a joking way, but you're serious. So
yeah.
Like, I knew I'd have to talk about this event.
Yeah, it's like, damn it, like.
No, you know, I think lately, it's probably gone more down like the joking and humor road because I've just been so busy. And you know, I think the audience is like where, you know, where's a something I can laugh at. And I like putting those jokes. I just like comedy in general. I've always wanted to do like an open mic night stand up routine.
I do, too. But that's so scary. So scary.
Oh, you better have, you know, but you got to do it. I'm that kind of guy that can probably take, you know, crickets in the crowd and learn a thing or two from it. I'm all right with that level of rejection. I say that to you when, in all honesty, I'm probably not.
You're going to be crying.
But yeah, I mean, the jokes kind of work like this. I want, you know, if you're reading them and following along, they're definitely plugging into the current narrative or headlines or stories of the day. I'm trying my best to, you know, on one hand laugh, on the other hand, have you think maybe a half a thought about what that topic is. Like if you didn't get the joke, maybe you'll go look it up and find out what I'm talking about. And therefore you learn something that day. Maybe I'll give my own like opinion through humor. Maybe it's just a joke, man. Maybe it's just a fart joke. Like it doesn't really, it doesn't really matter. I used to do a lot better job like throwing in non-jokes, like real financial, like.
But now it's just Brayson, Xavier, and the Brayden talking
about
Bitcoin.
Yeah, Tristan,
prices.
Brayden, Taylor, you know. I created that template a year and a half ago. Everyone loves it. But yeah, I mean, the Twitter thing. Yeah, my friend asked me the other day, are you going to get burnt out of this? I feel like I'm built for it. Like I could keep going here.
It's like part of your brand now.
Yeah,
it is your brand.
I was worried at first, like, is that, you know, am I just going to be a clown saying these things? But prospects, clients, people I meet, they like get the shtick. Like, I haven't really had to justify why I'm doing it. And there wasn't
a... one of my favorite responses was one of your tweets at I think it was a weekend or a holiday. And you said, Bitcoin's gone down, but my stocks haven't moved, clearly meaning stocks are superior. And people were responding like, seriously, like the market's closed today, you doofus. And then someone would be like, it's clearly a joke. And he's like, in a suit and tie with a blue check mark. And I'm supposed to think this is not for reals.
That's the thing, man. You really get to see what, you know, who and what's out there in kind of a little microcosm here. Look, some of the stuff is baiting. Some of the stuff is to, you know, hopefully have you, you know, not under, like yesterday, man, when people don't, I actually get a little nervous sometimes, you know, I'm really not here to hurt anyone or.
I see you deleting tweets sometimes. I do it a lot.
A lot. I mean, I view that like this. You know, if you're a comedian, right, and you're telling jokes and stand up and trying out material, and something bombs or it doesn't go well, you're never going to hear that joke ever, ever again. So, you know, in that light, why have like a terrible joke? You know, it's not coming from a mean place. It's let's see if this thing hits. And sometimes they don't.
Yeah, I have my like per minute ratio, you know.
Yeah, you can tell how something's going to do within maybe a couple minutes.
I sent you a banger tweet the other day you got to post.
You did. Yeah, you gave me a good one. I morphed it and put it out there.
I could totally see you two working off each other on a stand-up comedy. I would go. I mean, I would go.
It'd be funny.
Yeah.
To us, it'd be funny to us.
Yeah, or me and your wife would just be the only ones laughing in the crowd. Like,
my wife would not be laughing at my joke. She'd be booing me.
She'd be like, "Oh no,"
heckling. She'd be heckling me. But yeah, it's worked out. It's a nice shtick. It's really grown the audience. I'm you know, my whole goal was to have people laugh and take a break. Finance, you know, it's people get very serious about this. You know, there's not a lot of lightheartedness involved in it. I think, you know, with the crypto narratives and meme stunks and everyone's get, you know, now you tell a joke about Robin Hood and the AMC apes, they come out, they're still mad. Like, they're really, really mad. And, you know, you get this little contingency of people in this corner hamlet of Twitter, of financial Twitter, the AMC group, and yo, they're like, screw Robin Hood, you know. And I'm just like, this is a pure play joke, guys. And they're mad. They're very, very mad. And you could do that to a Bitcoin maximalist. They'll get upset. You know, don't people hold the stocks they love as religion, and humor and that sometimes don't mix. So, you know, I think we could use like a refresh of like some of the stuff we're talking about, like meme stocks are overplayed, like Robin Hood's less exciting to tweet about now that it's public versus when it was, you know, pre-IPO.
Yeah, because now if you talk shit, it's like some people are holding it and then you piss them off.
Yeah, you're not going to make everyone happy, and you try and say something that, again, hopefully has a little bit of wit to it, so you get it. But so a lot of times there's a lot of people who they're just not here for it. I'm sorry to anyone I've ever offended through a joke. I don't want anyone to lose money. I hope you crush it, but unfortunately not all of you will make money.
Do you trade at all? Like, do you like just like wake up some days and you're like,
here?
Yeah, like,
why do these guys want me on their primarily trading podcast?
Like, was your weekend
I just want your hair
about,
products.
Was your yeah. weekend tweet about stocks and Bitcoin? You just actually had no idea the market was closed on the weekend.
And that tweet was deliberately to say the market was closed on the weekend and crypto is open and it was doing poorly. I mean, you know, these things then just get repeated and beaten to death. Hugh asked if I trade.
Yeah, like a little fun account, you know, on the side.
I pick some things here and there, but I wouldn't even call it trading. More like the opportunity portfolio, where I'll take some real high conviction positions and I'll sit on them. Like they got to be 5-10 year plays. So that's not even That's not even trading. It's not even trading.
So you're not looking for VWAPs and EMAs, huh?
I'm amazed by what you guys do and the systems you need to build and the discipline you need to do what you guys do on a day in and day out. Like, I follow you guys. I follow all your friends, all the legends, you know, that you have on here in the trading world. And I'm just like, holy shit. Like,
none of this makes sense.
What are they taught? I can't even read a chart. Like, there's a curved line. There's 8 colored lines. There's a candlestick.
So why would anyone trust you to manage their wealth? I mean, I haven't seen you post a single picture of a Lamborghini, not one Gucci belt. I haven't seen you at any Louis Vuitton stores. I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, you're known for all the millennials trusting you or whatever, but how'd you get their trust if you haven't posted one Rari?
Because there's many ways, many, many ways to grow your wealth and get to your goals. And I respect how you guys are doing it. And it's, you know, tested. You can put down your track record if anyone's doubting what you do. I mean, throw up the P&L if there are haters out there.
Maybe not this month, but
but for me and my clients, you know, it's so the opposite of the environment that you're operating in here. It's about savings rates. It's about increasing income and leveraging skills and opportunities that come their way based in their careers. It's about being disciplined and knowing when to take opportunities, playing long games. And it's not any better or any worse. You know, people can choose how it is they want to grow their wealth. I say the core of what I really do is the financial planning piece, where the investment part is just a subset, just one particular area of what we deal with. No one's gonna, you know, get excited when I start mouthing off about estate planning strategies, tax planning, you know, insurance planning and cash management. Like, no one wants to hear that. But at the end of the day, that's what people are paying me bucks for. Right? They're paying me money to iron all of these details out so they can make great decisions. Maybe it does lead to them taking 10% of their investable net worth and trading and learning a thing or two, making money, losing money, figuring out what they do and don't like. But, you know, needless to say, Most of my clients, you know, one or two kids under the age of five running around, they're working 70, 80 hour a week jobs as, you know, white collar professionals, entrepreneurs, you know, grinders, and, you know, trying
to. They don't have time to buy Wish.
They don't have time. So, you know, Dan, it's not even that. They don't have time to create a risk adjusted portfolio of ETFs. Like, you need to understand, like, time to look at a chart, dude. They don't have time to click rebalance. And that's why, and people are like, oh, you can, you know, index yourself. Yeah, you can. I'll be the first person to say you can, you know, invest for free. Long-term risk-adjusted investing, Betterment, Wealthfront, Fidelity, Vanguard. You can do it for absolutely free. They don't have the time. They're going to pay, you know, up to 1% a year on their assets to not do it. Not because they're smarter than me. Some of them are, you know, more successful than me. And yet here we are, you know, doing this, you know, lift for them of investing their wealth, the majority of their wealth in very disciplined, non-sexy, vanilla type stuff, because their time is just worth so much money and they don't want to do it themselves.
So do you just love digging into people's finances, or was this more of, I mean, you and I have had this conversation, is this was more like you were just destined for this because of your father? Like, what, like, do you just love this, or is this just part of the end goal, whatever that may be?
It's a really big question. I don't think anyone in the whole world, you know, when you were growing up, right, you knew the kid who's like, I'm going to be a fireman, a policeman, a teacher, a few kids maybe like lawyer, judge. Who did you know that was like, I'm going to be an investment banker, I'm going to be a financial advisor? Like, you know, it's like, what's wrong with that
guy? I can't
guy?
Believe like your dad was just like, hey, let's see if you do this well. And now 18 years later, you're just doing it. Seems like you hit the nail on the head there.
He's still testing them out.
Yeah, still trying to see if this is what I love. No, I do love it. I do love this. And I got very, very fortunate that it tapped into like a number of skills that I'm particularly good at. And the biggest one just being where I get my energy from. And that's working with people. Like I want to be in a room crowded with people, you know, and just going around. That's what excites me. And then to pair that with the ability to help individuals. Right. So, you know, my dad did have a good way of always phrasing what it is we do for people. It's having the mind of a capitalist and the heart of a social worker. And that's always resonated with me because, here, you know, I make my money on helping people achieve their goals. Right. It's not just, you know, the investment piece always comes second to the planning that we do. And when you see your client close on a home and put their kids in it and get that new job because you've helped advise and put them in, you know, a position to make great decisions, it's a really massive reward. I'll never forget being invited to a client's house for dinner, barbecue, and them looking me in my eye and saying, you know, my dad was over, their father was over there the other day and said, you know, you should thank your financial advisor for setting this all up for you. And they were like, yeah, we really do appreciate him. And to, you know, my wife is sitting next to me hearing this. It's those moments that, you know, I don't know how many jobs are out there where you can get, you know, that kind of satisfaction and that kind of feedback in almost real time, or see the results of what you do for people. Right. And that's why it's drifted so far away from transactional type stuff like Sling. You know, this is born out of the brokerage era. Right. Slinging stocks, mm-hmm. hot stock picks. You know, let me sell you some IBM nice and safe. Now let me sell you the penny stock. Right. And now that's gone. And you have to focus on relationships that go the distance here. So I stepped in it, guys, like, you know, and then what had really, I think, happened. And I'm going long in the tooth on this one. What had happened is that a challenge had presented itself. I think I got, you know, when you start young, I got to a point where I was like, how am I going to basically do this on my own, right? How am I going to build out this business? And a lot of people saying like, here's how you need to do it. You need to go find baby boomers and people with money. You know, that's the only way. Just follow in the footsteps of everyone behind you. And I just was like, no, that's not the way. There's a different way. I was watching my friends and my wife, then girlfriend, really struggle out of 08 and 09. And I saw that the current model of wealth management was not aligning to what the needs were for my generation. And then it was like, okay, so how do we build a business around that? What, you know, and that was a challenge. And I'm sitting in business school at the same time and learning things that I could apply into doing this. And it was kind of like, what are you going to do? Take 10 plus years of all this work that you put into becoming this financial advisor and not challenge yourself to see if you can't build it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. What do you think? Because this is something that I don't want to say I talk to myself about, because that'd be weird and I'm not weird. Okay. What do you think is the biggest financial mistake that any generation, if you feel like boomers make different financial mistakes than, you know, millennials, but what do you think is like the biggest financial mistake that most people make?
I think it's jumping into investments without laying the strong foundation that you need to stay invested. Like if you're going to go invest, you should have a strategy. You should know what you're investing for. That can be very difficult when you don't master or get a good grip on the fundamentals, like knowing how money comes in and out of your life, right? So that's cash flow, making sure that you can withstand the volatility or risk that you plan on taking in your portfolio. Nobody, you know, wants to go through a 50, 60% drawdown, which could be part, you know, of their strategy. You might have to deal with that as part of their strategy. Where people blow themselves up, especially inexperienced people, is with their own behavior and their own emotions. That's the biggest threat. And the best way to mitigate that risk of your own behaviors and your own brain backfiring or working against you is knowing that you got stability underneath your feet, or you got dry powder backing you, right? Or you know that what's happening here with your strategy isn't going to bleed into the things that are critically important in your life. And I think that's very hard, especially for younger people who, you know, have three responsibilities in life, you know, don't get fired, don't die, and pay your bills. Like when that's all that you got on the line and you can take more risks, these things just make it that much more difficult. So I think that's the number one thing, right? And if you're really into financial education and literacy, you'll really want to promote, you know, building that foundation. It's going to serve you well throughout your entire life. And sometimes I think what a lot of people have a difficult time, you know, dealing with, and I agree with this, is, you know, the sooner you can get investing, the sooner you can start compounding that growth, right? The sooner you get in, the better off you're going to be over a long period of time. And sometimes building foundations and creating liquidity for yourself and backstops, you know, it takes time to do that. And therein lies the rub, right? Am I really going to sacrifice 3-4 years of compounding returns to, you know, build the foundation? And I rather do the foundational piece. That doesn't mean there isn't room to invest at the same time. It's just, if you're diving headfirst into the investment piece and leaving behind foundational stuff, you're, I think, reducing the probability that you can stay the course.
I kind of haven't. I totally thought it was buying Starbucks was the biggest financial mistake.
That would be very on brand for me. But you bring up a good point, Dan, because it's not, you know, as much as I joke around about, you know, you can't retire if you buy a cup of coffee. I mean, that's all nonsense. And I hope people really appreciate that. Like, there's no point in, you know, not having fun or living a crappy lifestyle. So not crappy, but so uncomfortable of a lifestyle that you're really sucking the joy out of your life. Like, if cups of coffee is the reason you can't, I mean, that's really messed up. It's usually housing expense and transportation are your number one, number two. So if you're like first job balling out, you know, in the fancy apartment, got the fancy car, you know, ahead of the earnings and the building that you've done, Mr. Porsche up here.
Hey, I'm moving in 3 weeks.
And you're moving to Houston too. You're going to get that sick pad. But, you know, Dan, we can joke about, you know, you doing these things, but I'm sure you would, you know, very easily be able to show me the pathway you went through to be able to have these nice things and live that level of comfort, right? It's just when you get into those things before putting in the work, or not understanding how much delayed gratification can really benefit you early on, that I think, you know, people make mistakes there as well.
But I actually think not to a point where you know, I'm Gary V or Graham Stephan preaching the fact that you, like, if you buy coffee from anywhere that's over 25 cents, like, you'll get crucified. But, you know, I still use, like, fast food coupons. I'm a fast food addict. It's all I eat. And I still, like, Honey, the app, not sponsored, but amazing.
It's an awesome app.
Dude, whenever COVID first started, they had this thing with any purchase at Burger King. I don't even like Burger King, but I'd be losing money not doing this deal. With any purchase, you get two free Happy Meals. So I was getting two toys or ice cream, should I prefer that, fries and or apples or onion rings, which their onion rings aren't bad, and two cheeseburgers or nuggets, all for $1, which I would just buy, like, you know, eight nuggets or four, whatever. I was robbing them.
Dude, man. You're feeding the entire high school, man.
But I was just feeding me. That's the thing.
Look, I got to go with Dan on this. I'm a fast food junkie myself. Like, I've really curbed it just because it was having some, you know, you're younger than me. You can burn it. You know, we're skinny guys. Look at us. We're, you know, we can burn it. Yeah, we can burn it off real fast. We got that gift of that fast metabolism. It eventually starts to, you know, slow down. You know, I'm just letting you know. Uh-oh. Hope not. No, but you can, you know, a couple runs will burn it off. This reminds me of a video. It was a TikTok video of someone who was gaming the McDonald's menu. Like, if you just bought, you know, like, it was arbitrage on the nuggets. Like, they got the pricing where, like, if you just comboed up 20 pieces instead of, like, the 50 or the 10s, yeah, or something like, yeah, that, I forget, yeah, what the math was, but, like, you basically can get more nugs for free, but or more nugs more cheaply by choosing a certain combination of things. Yeah, man, like, again, back to that central point about what people do wrong. I mean, and coffee and these small things, if you're in control of where your money goes, if you have a really keen idea on the month to month what your cash flow looks like, nobody should be able to comment on how it is you spend your money. One of the first things I tell any prospect in our consultation is, I will not be the kind of financial advisor that tells you how to spend your money. What I want to know is, what are the goals? When do you want to achieve that goal? How much is it going to cost? And of the goals that you had, which are the most important? Because we have to prioritize where the first and last dollar of available savings is going to go. This isn't hard math. This is just logical thinking things through and organizational type thinking. And once you do these very basic things and write them down and see them before you, all of a sudden you go from, you know, the void of not knowing what the heck you're doing with your finances to having some pretty good, you know, pretty good organizational pieces around that. And that's, I think, the big difference between people who do very well when it comes to managing their money. I think some of those are the best investors out there because they're able to understand risk and their tolerance for that risk a lot better, and sizing positions a lot better relative to their goals and their net worth and other assets that they have. So if you can kind of get that, that's what financial planning is, right? You get that big picture. You can see your financial life like Neo sees the Matrix.
I do personally, and this is, I do have an issue. Like, okay, I was doing the math with somebody because the parking garage attendant, okay, we talk here and there, okay? And so we had this conversation.
He talks to, and they bring home about 100 everywhere, by the way.
It's called, you know, due diligence, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the maintenance guys downstairs. Guess who opened up a Roth IRA once I moved in? The John from maintenance. He's great. His son goes to Rutgers. It's great. I hold financial education in the living room on Saturday mornings. But I will say, though, because when I start to do the math, I do. Okay, part of where I think we really run into issues is, for instance, this person, $120 a shift. Let's just say their take home was $100, $10 at Starbucks, $30 Uber Eats, keeps the air conditioning on inside the car. Like, I was like, dude, like, you're making like $20. Like when you minus all your expenses, your transportation, you know, even if it's only $6, you know, you add all that up and now you're at like $40, $50. What's your rent?
That person's,
you know, like,
making
like that.
$12 an hour. I think it's a different story.
But my point is that how many people, okay, the average American salary is what, $55,000 a year? I mean, that's not, you know, I mean, that's what, $23 an hour? I mean, that's not super far off. So, I mean, even, go ahead. I see you getting ready. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think you have to be careful here, right? And I think in my vast experience here, you know, painting with broad brushes sometimes really, you know, does us a disservice. There's a few things. I don't think you said anything really wrong there, but, you know, you're in Hoboken, right?
I am.
All right. So, you know, we're in an expensive part of the country. You know, there's comment here on wage growth and what it is, and inflation and the cost of living on a geographical basis. But if you put that all aside for a second, you know, people are going to be like, well, I can't make more money as a result of the conditions that I have, you know, whether it be their upbringing, their responsibilities, what they had access to, so on and so forth. And I think that's where the danger lies. But I'll validate your point, right? Depending on how much you make, so if you make less or money is tighter, it makes it only that much more critical to be very cognizant of how it is you're going about spending your money. And again, someone would say like, well, my hands are tied here. I can't go get another job. I can't do these things for very valid reasons. And I, you know, you kind of have to stop there and be like, my heart really goes out to that. If that's, you know, certainly the case, I, you know, is it a, you know, something that needs to be settled at the voting booth? Is it something you need, you know, on a more societal level to change in order for them to get ahead? There's that road, which we got to be careful going down. And then there's the other road of just, how are you spending your money? Like, did you need to do the Uber Eats? Did you need to, you know, DoorDash four nights a week? So this is what I tell my clients, regardless of income. You know, as much as I tell them, I don't care how you spend your money. I care that you're getting towards your goals. What I'm really saying here is like the way, you know, I want you to identify what that lifestyle expense is. Right. I want you to understand, you know, what comfort is to you based on what it is you're able to earn. Are we, you know, first and foremost, are we running a deficit? Are you taking on debt to support your lifestyle? If so, we got to fix that right away, you know, if possible. And then the second is, are you, you know, just spending above and beyond? If you told me your goal was to buy a house in the next 4 years, I'd be like, okay, how much does that house cost? You'd be like, $400,000. Can we put 10% down on that? Be aggressive. So 40K, if it's 20% down, 80K. We got to save $40,000 to $80,000 over the next 4 years, right? And you're like, I'm going to do this. And we look at cash flow and we see, all right, like, let's just do that math real quick. 40K over 4 years, 48, we got to save $833 a month, repetitive, 33 over and over again. We got to come up with 833. Number one, is that feasible? Like, with what you make, can you literally save $833 after tax to make that happen? That's question number one. And if you can, is there any sacrifices from your lifestyle that needs to be made in order to get there? Let's say you can make that happen. I check in with you 3 months later, you should have somewhere around the neighborhood of $2,400 saved up, right? $2,500 saved up. But you come and say, look, I only got $2,000 here. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to beat you up. What happened? Yeah, you know, it could be something happened with the car. I had to replace something. All right, cool. I'm going to make these changes next month to catch up. Fantastic. Like, that's the kind of thinking I like to see. Or how about this? No, we only have $1,000 when we should have 24. Well, what happened? We went on a vacation. Why'd you go on that vacation? We were burnt out. We needed to recharge. I figured things would go downhill. Fine. Are we going to then change behavior over the next quarter to make up for that? Yes. Okay. Or, you know what? Maybe that was too aggressive of a goal. Instead of buying a home in 4 years, it really needs to be 6. Now you're moving the goalpost, which may be okay. You can't keep moving the goalpost, but maybe in order to adapt to a lifestyle that's more comfortable for you, because that's what you need to do well, you make that change. Fine, that's acceptable too. You can move the goal or you can change the behavior. It's when people say to me, why am I not getting to my goal? Are you gonna change your behavior? No. All right, if you're not, you know, are you gonna move the goal? Nah. All right, well, we got a problem here, you know? That's on you.
Have you ever dropped a client because of that exact thing? Or at all, have you ever dropped a client, period?
I have dropped the client, not because of that. very, very interesting thing to do, very hard thing to do. It really just comes down to personality fit. And it's not like, no one should be yelling at each other. It's, if I recognize it's not going to be a good long-term relationship, and this is very few and far between, I think the first thing you do is say, hey, can I find you someone I think would be an amazing advisor for you? Like, I appreciate our relationship, but I just feel like someone can really do a better job here and you'll like them. You know, A, they're going to get the hint, you know, and just leave anyways. But no, I haven't dropped anyone for not listening. And nobody really wants to work in a – no one wants to have a working relationship where they're not taking, you know, they're paying for something, they're not taking. I don't want someone to pay me just to not and then not take the advice. It's I don't know, it's not
one time
not
I had
me.
a probation officer that dropped me and sent me to another probation office. Is that impressive?
I believe that.
I mean, I thought,
could you imagine that conversation? Like, you were just like,
I would imagine it's not because you were I would like to think it's not because you were doing anything wrong related to probation. I would just like to think it was you. Like, he just couldn't take your interactions.
Yeah. It was a woman.
You just asked her a bunch of questions?
No. I decided it'd be my interview, basically, you know? Yeah. Now, I hosted that podcast. I'll say that. But no, I mean, I'm sorry if this is just me being ignorant to what you do, but do you ever, like, for your job, you never telling people about how to buy houses, do you ever say, like, damn, the house market is busting right now, you should sell your house?
I've told people no. It's not my favorite part of the job. Telling people to sell their house usually doesn't come up. I think there's retirees where I'm like, hey, you know, whatever your retirement plan was, you know, given the real estate market, does it make sense to accelerate it or to sell the home and rent for a little bit before you retire? You know, small portion of the book is the retirees or the parents of my younger clients. But I think one of the things you got to get good at in my role is when a client called me up the other day, they love going to a certain beach town. And they really wanted the beach house, and we were looking at everything. And I had to say no. I had to say no because the market was crazy. And I thought, no beach house for you. And I think, you know, advisors or managers are afraid to necessarily, you know, sometimes in at least early on, afraid to say no. You know, and you got to get good at that because you're ultimately, and you explain why. You know, and to Dan's point, you know. Do you want to carry this much more of an expense every month? Do you want to buy an asset at the tippy top of the market here? And you walk them through it and you try and show them that this might not be the best move for them. And then sometimes you're just like, no, like, don't do this.
I don't want you to be offensive to anyone, but is there any type of client that is harder? Is just, you're like, damn, this is going to be, whether it be about to retire, you know, maybe an 18-year-old that
Fintwit.
Just doesn't want to live alone.
Could you imagine dealing with Fintwit?
Yeah. They say, like, no, I want 2 Lamborghinis by preferably Christmas.
It's 90% of my net worth into a penny stock. Yeah.
Only one time did I have a lady, like, really put forth asinine goals. Like... like, I want to trip, like, the ask was, I want to triple my money over the next 1 to 2 years. And that's, you know, like, I get it. It obviously it can, respect. It can be, yeah, I with respect, I, it can be done. I'm not the guy to help you do that. It's just not, you know, what I do. You got, this is where you guys step into the play here.
I mean, you could also lose it all, Miss
Lady. Yeah,
tell them
close to expiration options.
I mean, it was, I want to triple my money so I can retire in the next 5 years. And it's just like, everything about what I'd recommend would be wildly inappropriate to do that. And I don't have the skill set to even, you know, start in on the risk taking that would need to take place. The probability you'll come out successful here is not very good. And I don't think you want to take on that kind of risk. But The type of clients that typically don't work out well are the ones that check their accounts and are you know, every day and call you up, you know, when there's the most innocuous of movements in the market. He was like, yeah, I'd call every day. What's going on here?
Dude, Dougie, me and you'd be having breakfast every morning.
You don't think the Bollinger Band, you don't think the Bollinger Band on this stock is, you don't think we should sell? You seriously waiting so long?
Yeah, again, the compare and contrast and the way that, you know, we operate respectively. If there's anything I learned when I moved to New York City in 2008 and 2009, working in another practice while the sky was literally falling, you know, this is free fall recession, 50% drawdown on the S&P. I spent a year just fielding phone calls from clients for my senior advisor, and I could hear the fear. It was every day, pick up the phone, and, yeah. You know, and there were older clients.
That's tough.
Yeah. And it was great training. I mean, you can't replace that kind of learning. But one of the big lessons I pulled away from and why I chose to go after younger clientele was there's no way I could grow a business if I had to be on the phone like that every day. Number two, I felt that if I could train and do financial planning for people early in their lives and train them up, they'll never have to worry like those folks were necessarily worrying. And it's not a mark against the advisor I was working for. This was an unprecedented thing unfolding, you know, in the economy. But I just took away from that, like, no, I don't want to necessarily have to deal with clients like that. And they're wonderful people. But if you're calling me up, you know, twice a week about stuff related to the market rather than stuff related to decisions you need to make in your life, that's probably not going to be a good relationship long term.
Okay. Well, that's a fair answer. I guess I don't want you as my financial advisor because I just don't think our goals are aligned. You know, I'm just thinking bigger, man.
Listen, Dan, bold of you to assume I would even have you as a client.
Whoa.
I would be the one you dropped.
Yeah. Oh, dude, Dougie, me and you, we would have the most complex planning just to do nothing. I mean, it would just be, we would be inside a big circle, you know, just.
I'd be like, so Hugh, what do you think of the planning? Did you execute on the recommendations found in the plan? You'd be like, I don't know where the plan even is located.
Yeah, be like, Doug, can you share that with me again?
I'd be calling.
I actually took the. You know,
you're giving me life advice, so I've been talking to this girl, right, and she's great, but.
See, I actually would like that call. I really would. I mean, and you have to understand so much of it. I like when you said I'm thinking bigger. That's not wrong, man. Like. The conversation, like when you do the planning and you start putting people's financial lives together so they can think clearly about their money, what eventually happens in these relationships is you get into the career side of things and career and helping them solve problems there. Because there's, look, it's a practice of 130 households all between the ages of like 26 and 42. There's solution sets to problems that keep popping up in clients' lives. You can be like, oh yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Smith or the Johnsons or whoever. You know, they dealt with this very same issue you're dealing with. This is how they solved that, you know. And I apologize to all your viewers. Like, what the hell is this guy talking about? These aren't stocks. But look, you know, this is what we're doing for people.
Yeah. So what about the people who you can't really? I mean, you know, because I'm assuming that for the most part you kind of outline, you know. A budget and what exactly is going to be your inflow and outflow. You know, I mean, I guess your outflow can be a little, can be better budgeted, but your inflow for people like us, how do you kind of handle that? And how would someone like us handle it?
Yeah. So I call that variability in income. And I see it with professions like yours. I see it with primarily salespeople who have, you know, base salaries that are dwarfed by their commission or incentive income. Right. And that makes it hard to plan around, you know, savings and goals when you could have a year that's $200,000 and a year that's $850,000. right? So typically you break that up into three scenarios. What I like to do is break it up into three scenarios. Show me what do you expect that W-2 or 1099 to look like in a year where you're like, shit, if I do that again, I'm getting fired or I have to quit. Show me this was a good year and show me, you know, a banner year. And then you can map out, you know, on a low, medium, and high basis, what that's going to look like. So a lot of this is just expectation setting, right? And being able to show a few examples of what would happen if your expectations were on a bad year all the way up to an amazing year. You do what you guys are doing long enough, you kind of know what your floor is and you kind of know what your ceiling is if you're being honest with yourself.
Yeah, the ceiling got real fucked up after COVID.
Yeah, I mean, now it's stocks only go up. Everyone thinks, you know, I'll just, you know, compound 100% returns, 1,000% returns every year. Okay, there's something to be said about that. But what about inevitably the years where, and you guys operate a little differently here because you're going very specific with your picks and how you invest. But, you know, what about, what if you have a year where you're down $200,000? What is that really going to do for you guys in terms of the goals that you have for yourself? What even are the goals?
That basement's mine.
Come down. That, we yeah, got you. That, you're not far.
If I have a losing year like that, that basement's mine, Dougie.
Yeah.
Child care is always needed.
If I have a down year, man, all the promises that people made, hey, you know, come, I'll buy you lunch. I made a list and I'm going down. I've got all those free lunches marked.
Right now the list is Hugh gets a week in the Bonaparte basement.
Yeah. I'm soccer coach now and dance recital teacher for a little bit, you know.
Ruby's like, why is that smelly man down in the basement still?
He said that you need to be riskier with your investments, Dad.
Tried to sell me Wish.
All right, Doug. Well, unlike you, we have shit to do. The market's still open for us. So, you know, we have loved chatting with you. And, you know, I know you only do these to get more Twitter followers. So make sure everyone goes and follows Doug Bonaparte on Twitter.
Dan is never having me back. I have a feeling he's never allowing me back on this show again.
Yeah, he actually just texted me like, dude, why? Who is this again? Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Grayson, Tristan, and Brandon a little more on Twitter. I want to talk about Twitter jokes, and you're over here talking about, like, you know, how to set financial goals for yourself.
The jokes are only going to get better. So when you have me back on the show, we'll do a recap of, you know, Doug's tweets in review.
Well, I mean, Doug, can we, you know, I mean, I know that you're a big CNBC guy, Forbes guy, but I mean, you know, I heard that there is one certain media outlet that that you got recognized on the most.
Which one's that? Which one could it be? Could it be Penny's Going in Raw podcast?
I mean, I'm not sure. That's just like the rumor around like the FinTwit Twitter. I mean, but if you have a story.
Listen, do not sleep on PGIR. I came on this thing the first time. I didn't have a clue really who you guys were. I noticed it was really kind of like Hugh that was liking some tweets and replying, and it was you were still anonymous, right? You still had the AVR. And I had no idea what to think about you, dude. And all of a sudden you were talking about Roth IRAs. Anyways, came on the show. Dude, within a few weeks of doing that first episode, I got a call from my dad who had a service guy over for the house. I don't know what they were fixing. And he's like, Bonaparte, that sounds familiar. Oh, yeah, I heard your son on, you know, my dad didn't even know what the podcast was. But
yeah, he's like, what are you doing now, son? You're on Going in What?
He knows I do all this stuff. I had another guy from high school hit me up on like LinkedIn. He's like, we went to high school. It's your brother's year. I heard you on PGIR. That was two. Then I had a number of DMs that were like, are you taking on clients? You guys are responsible for bringing me business. So Dan, here's what you get. You're going to get an all-you-can-eat Burger King experience next time you come to town. All right. So $12 gets you 12 items. And Hugh, man. Hugh, you're going to get some fancy cocktails.
Fancy, oh, dude, Doug, you don't want to mix off, man. My ranch water is
it looked good. I felt bad. I felt bad tweeting you on that one because it was a solid drink. It looked great. It looked refreshing, but I felt like I had a flex on you, and we got to get your cocktail game, to the moon, man.
Well, I mean, I was drinking Smirnoff like last year in college, so I'm still getting used to
just got upgraded ordering, from Jungle Juice.
Jungle Juice to Macallan 18 in a year. That's a pretty big increase.
I'm hanging out with people like you now. The big shots,
You got to keep up with the Joneses. That's what we're trying to avoid here, guys. Can't thank you enough. This podcast is legit. I've been on a lot of podcasts, and I can tell you that after doing an episode, usually get some people to reach out. I haven't seen anything quite like that. So it means you're doing something right. You really, really are. I mean, you're reaching people here, which is phenomenal. Hats off. Congrats again.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks, man. And don't ever drop any of that hair gel into your mixology. That's bad mix.
I need a cut.
All right. See you, man. Thanks.
See you, bro.